The guest stars on tonight's Midweek Drive include Professor Jason Whittaker, Sam Stone, and David J. Howe, with special guest from San Francisco, Buck from Hawaii. Yay! So there we are, Buck. Whereabouts in San Francisco are you at present?
I am presently on a streetcar, thus all the noise, and I think I will exit because it's going to be very difficult for you to hear. So I am exiting the streetcar.
And it's not a streetcar called Desire. I got in there ahead of you, David. Please.
Although I am surrounded with desire of all sorts.
Well,
for sure.
He's San Francisco. Do you have flowers in your hair?
No, not currently.
What?
Maybe if I could use Snapchat.
Yeah, you see, that's the technological 21st century addressing the Scott McKenzie classic. So, normally when we reach you, you're in Hawaii, and this week, of course, you're in San Francisco. So what takes you back to the mainland or the very big island?
Well, you know, I work so hard back at home that I decided I needed a little break, and so I used some well-earned time and flight miles and flew here for free and just to see some friends for a real quick trip. I've got my friend David back at home that's taking care of my guests and my felines and things, and I'm just here for the shortest trip I think I've ever taken, just 4 nights away. And my friends asked me to bring the sun with them, and I must say, somehow I delivered, because it's a beautiful sunny day here. And I'm right here on Market Street, the famous Market Street, and looking down at the ferry building at one end and the, I forget what they call it, the radio tower at the other end at the Upper Castro. But it's a gorgeous city. I just love this city. I don't know if you've ever been here. But such a great sense of community and such a wonderful transportation here. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles, and you just have to drive everywhere. And I think public transportation really lends to community, I think, because you just end up talking to people on the transport. And so it's nice. And I was, you'll get a kick out of this. The first thing I did was went to the store and bought myself a little box of PG chips.
Nice.
So I could be taken care of.
I always feel this is critical, Buck, that, you know, we keep those elements of Britishness alive in the former colonies. If you can't get your PG tips, life's not worth living.
I'm surprised they even sell it there.
And it's not a euphemism,
yes,
Sam. Brilliant.
I'd love to know if you've been to Alcatraz yet. Have you been to Alcatraz yet?
I only went once years ago on the ferry, of course, takes you out there. And
yes,
it was just a stop. And I didn't get out. There were, I don't know. I didn't know. I've never done the tour there. I've never done the tour. It was just a quick stop, and we were picking people up and dropping people off, and but no, I've never been there. But it's nice. It's really amazing to look out from the bay and imagine what it was like in the day. You know, of course, there's great white sharks in that icy cold water, one of the elements that kept them all in there. Recently in Los Angeles, last year, I was visiting my sister, and her husband had a ball and chain that his son had given him that had Alcatraz printed on it. It was this heavy, heavy steel ball with cuffs that would go either on your ankles or on your hands. And I just thought that was the coolest thing, you know? Probably worth quite a bit of money.
Another classic case of memorabilia.
Yeah.
Now, as we look at the opening credits from the 1970s classic, Streets of San Francisco there,
yeah,
Hyde Street Pier, is that around?
Hyde Street Pier, you know, I'm not that familiar with it. I certainly know where Fisherman's Wharf is. It's got to be right over there. It's got to be one of the piers along the Bayfront there. You know, they're all numbered.
And is there still the ghost of Carl Malden and his hat there? Because, I mean, I feel obviously Carl left us a few years ago, but, you know, these are classic televisual icons. In fact, many ways, Jason, this is mainly the academic I am today, the streets of San Francisco. Never lied.
I think he must be memorialized in a mural on a brick building here somewhere.
I mean, just Jason, Streets of San Francisco, well, yet to be remade, of course.
I was just thinking of San Francisco itself, which is a great city. I worked there in the 90s, very briefly, and it's just the big difference to other American cities. It really invites you to walk around and
when Quinn Martin can actually have an episode title in
A Trout in the Milk.
I mean, what more could you ask? A Trout
two
in
trouts
the Milk.
In the milk.
tonight's episode, A Trout in the Milk.
Oh, dear.
That has to be sort of one of the greatest sort of numbers ever, really. I mean, in fact, you could actually sort of include a reference to that in your next novel, Sam.
Maybe.
Jason, have you been to San Francisco?
Yes, I worked there in the 90s for a brief period of time for
magazine. Buck's relatively brief sojourn over there, where would you say he should check out to see if it still exists in the same way as it was in the 20th century? And do they have the Professor Jason Whittaker
No, they won't have that there. I was chased out of the city, I think. No, not quite. Actually, the one that springs to mind, I'm afraid, is the place not to go, which is the Tenderloin, which when I was a 25-year-old man wandering around in the morning to get my newspaper and pint of milk, it's the one place I've nearly been stabbed, actually.
Don't go there.
Don't go there.
Do not go to...
But I went to City Lights bookstore.
The City Lights, but
yeah,
you can go with that. All right,
absolutely,
that's fine. Hopefully, Buck will be sorted because, after all, he's had to cope with Hawaii for quite some time. So, San Francisco and Hawaii, saw that. Buck, any other sort of particular sort of experiences that you wanted to share with us? Because the time in San Francisco now, I gather, it's just coming around to 10 a.m. Is that right?
Yes, 10 a.m. exactly. Yeah, I just had a lovely big breakfast, and I actually brought 5 beautiful white pineapples from my garden to give to my friends, and they went through strict scrutiny at the
customs, presumably.
The agricultural check. Unfortunately, they didn't do a very good job because when I got them here, they had fire ants on them, which is a terrible thing. So I felt just awful. So hopefully
they were just fire ants who wanted to see San Francisco, that's all. You know, they'd seen the movie Ants, they thought, let's go there, let's go with our friend Buck on his pineapples and cross the Pacific Ocean.
I really hope I haven't ruined agricultural here in San Francisco. And at the airport, I actually ran into a friend from the Big Island who was heading to Chicago, and she said, oh, bringing pineapples, what a good idea. And I gave her one. So the damage has been spread quite wide. I'm sorry.
Well, sometimes, Buck, the responsibilities of Midweek Drive correspondents, when they actually shift in those sort of areas, it could be a deal breaker in the presidential elections. It's the ants and the pineapples. David, have you checked out San Francisco?
I've never been to San Francisco, no. I've just got tonight's episode, Invasion of the Fire Ants, running through my head.
If they could do Hawaii 5-0 and redo that, I'm sure the streets
of San
Francisco...
I'm sure that would be there. It sounds like Police Squad episodes to me, rather than Streets of San Francisco. No, I've never been to San Francisco. It's a place that I would actually like to visit because I've seen pictures of it. Of course, we've seen that great big street where all the cars go down too fast and
Star Trek 4,
the
Voyage Home,
the streets and stuff. But I've never been there, and it's kind of, everyone says it's gorgeous and lovely, so I'd love to go there at some point.
Buck, I know you'd have to wait a couple of hundred years, but the Federation Starfleet headquarters will be based in San Francisco in the 23rd century. So just a couple of hundred years to actually wait, and it'll happen. But watch out for the two whales, Grace and Gertie. That's very important.
Oh, you remember their names. My goodness, I'm impressed.
They helped save the human race in the latter part of the 23rd century, so very important in terms of future history. Jason.
Welcome to Alex's world.
Yeah, yes. Actually, Alex could just be making anything up whatsoever with those names, and nobody around the table would be able to contradict him.
I would cite my sources and work their way through the process.
You'll have Alan on the phone, and Stevens would be taking the task.
Lennon Nimoy would be there as well. Anyway, Jason, any questions for Buck?
No, only to say that I hope you really enjoy the rest of your time in San Francisco.
And don't worry about the ants. We won't say anything. The fact that we broadcast the ant message across sort of the national radio and a whole variety of others, it's by the by. Yeah. You know, people will sort of choose selective memory. That's what it's all about, selective memory.
But maybe the ants were all the same sex. Maybe we could just hope that they were all just the same sex and that'll be it. They'll just live and die. And
well, unfortunately, that doesn't work because they make a queen out of any of the workers.
See, when it comes to basic biology, Buck is on the case, though.
He is, absolutely, yes.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
Good. So, Buck, I'm now going to hand over to Sam Stone to pop those last two questions to you in her own inimitable way. Go, Sam.
Buck, have you had a reasonably telephonic link with us today?
Interesting, you missed the word.
And I missed an interesting out there as well.
more fun than ever, yes. It's just wonderful. I hope that maybe I can do this again from somewhere else in the world.
I think you answered the second question without me asking.
Just to go with that notion, updates from our Hawaiian correspondent somewhere else in the world.
We want to know all about the fire ants next time.
We
shall follow it with enthusiasm and deep interest.
Disaster in San Francisco.
There are those of us who remember a Charlton Heston movie of the 1960s all about ants in Africa, and that was very scary.
So,
fire ants breathe fire? Do they kind of...
No, but they eat you alive. They're horrible. According to that film, they do. Anyway.
They can be quite problematic.
They call them fire ants because of their sting that is awful. It lasts about 45 minutes, and it itches and burns, and there's absolutely nothing you can put on that will make it go away. So, you just have to wait it out.
So it's a bite or something?
They bite you.
Yes. And they signal each other, and you'll get multiple stings on your body, and they all happen simultaneously.
And in the words of the immortal Stuart Goddard, don't tread on an ant, it's done nothing to you. Sorry, little Adam Ant moment there. Something from the 80s. And he went on to star in The Equalizer, so what's not to appreciate about that? Buck, final task for your good self. We can offer you a number of San Francisco-themed tunes, including Scott McKenzie's classic San Francisco, The Flowerpot Men, nice for the ants, of course, Let's Go to San Francisco, or indeed Tony Bennett's I Left My Heart in San Francisco. Which one do you want to go for?
Oh, I think Tony Bennett would be great.
I had a feeling you might go for him.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going home to my city by the bay. I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill, it calls to me to be where little cable cars climb halfway to the stars. The morning fog may chill the air. I don't care, my love waits there in San Francisco. Above the blue and windy sea, Francisco. Your golden sun will shine for me.
Which brings us to that immortal question, is he or is he not Tara Bennett's dad? Tony Bennett, related to yourself, Tara? I mean, grandfather, perhaps?
I wish. My dad used to joke that he was our cousin Tony Bennett, but no, we like to pass that around as the family lie, but no, Mr. Bennett is not actually related to me, I wish.
Yeah, the listener needs to know. And Tara, you may well be able to just confirm the statement I came out with a few moments ago, which was actually doubted by the Midwick Drivets, Professor Jason Whittaker, David J. Howe and Sam Stone. The two whales in Star Trek IV, the Voyage Home, are indeed called George and Gracie.
They definitely and absolutely are. I remember loving Good that Lord. Movie, and that stays in my head forever. Absolutely.
Sometimes, Jason, even students actually will doubt, but total veracity.
Sorry, Alex, ask a leading question and then get the answer you want. I remain a sceptic still. I've read it on Wikipedia, it's not real. I've been reading too many students' essays.
Yeah, but what you have to realise, Jason, is that Tara is Wikipedia. She knows everything about everything.
And when you've got a Facebook update which has a giant otter and Tara in the Game of Thrones.
Yes.
That's what it's all about. You know, classic stuff.
Fantastic.
So, Phil Leonis, who will be joining us in the next part of the programme, actually, was very negative about the summer of blockbusters, which he maintains is the worst ever. I disagree. I think there have been some moments which have been appropriate and good. And besides, if you go to see Suicide Squad, you don't expect to be uplifted. You know, the very nature of the title is such. Yeah. But you have indeed, including in the latest edition of SFX magazine, issue 277, always good because it has both a Tara Bennett rave and a Tara Bennett rant. The rant, what a bad summer for sequels. What a bad summer for sequels. I take it Independence Day didn't necessarily float your boat then, even though it was resurgence.
It was not my favorite. No, it was, I think, chapters of stories that we were looking forward to this summer didn't quite hit it for me. I've felt least compelled to go to the movies this summer than at the beginning of the summer. I was excited. But as every month has kind of poked along, I've been disappointed or just haven't really felt that compelled. I am late on Star Trek, and I am going to see that this week. So that is one I'm still very excited about seeing, and I've heard great things about. But myself and even just friends, not even professionally, a lot of people have felt underwhelmed by the offerings that we've had this summer, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing. I think sometimes things get in the pipeline and turned around for a release date rather than because they have a great story, and maybe because whenever it comes to losing money with the studios, they suddenly stop and pay attention. Maybe they'll rethink the way they've been going about making some of the sequels, and then that's a good thing for everybody.
Well, I mean, there is that, of course, and maybe we need a fallow period. I mean, Jason, are you still a sort of keen follower of movie blockbusters, or is it a case of, no, I'll just leave that for a while?
Loath to say it. The only one I've seen this summer is Star Trek Beyond, was disappointing, actually.
Even the holding up of the Star Trek V cast.
Absolutely.
Did it not give you a slight...
No, because it actually suffered the problem of lots of blockbusters of not having a proper plot. The writing's got a bit sloppy, yeah. That's a problem for me with a lot of the blockbusters. They've become longer, they need a damn good edit in many cases.
A damn good edit.
Yes, God damn it.
Exactly, very good. So we've just been joined in the studio by Patricia Ash. Patricia, welcome back to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
I'm not too bad, hello.
Very good. Another American voice, Tara. But somebody who actually moved from Texas to Lincolnshire, or Nottinghamshire, actually.
Nottinghamshire.
Nottinghamshire, exactly. And crosses the border on a monthly basis to do the stone tapes, and occasionally do part of the Midweek Drive as well.
Yes.
From your own perspective, the movie ecology scene, has it been positive or not so good? What's your thought?
I like the new Ghostbusters movie. Mm-hmm. I think people who make movies just want to give customers what they pay for, because movie tickets are ridiculous.
Even though,
I experienced like
last Friday,
long.
We had people who were in Suicide Squad who within 5 seconds actually had their mobile phones out and they were texting away merrily. I just thought, why go to see?
What
exactly are you texting? I mean, it irritated me, Tara. It irritated me to extent. Enough of this stuff. The rants, of course, from Tara this month. Basking in the anniversary nostalgia this summer of some all-time favourites, Big Trouble in Little China, Aliens and Labyrinth, all 30 years old.
Yes, and I feel excessively old because
that particular trio, Big Trouble in Little China, of course, set in San Francisco.
I love that film.
Yep. Aliens and Labyrinth all played a part in what grown-up Tara does professionally today as SFX West Coast editor extraordinaire and East Coast editor and USA editor. Moving dexterously onwards, Tara. We're going to take a mini musical break now to lead into your lead article from this month's SFX magazine, the world's number one science fiction magazine, because my big question for you is, it's all very well talking about sequels, but fundamentally, will we have this Helen Reddy number featured in the sequel? Yeah, you know what I'm going to say? And this is Helen Reddy sings her heart out. She even introduces it herself as we go back in time on the Midweek Drive, little under 10.5 minutes after 6 o'clock in Britain and approaching 11 minutes past 10 a.m. in Los Angeles.
I had a real fun experience last year. I got a chance to star in a motion picture called Pete's Dragon. One of the songs that I sing in the movie was nominated for an Academy Award. I'd like to sing the song for you now.
records, some say the 70s was Disney's forgotten decade, overshadowed by the golden eras either side of it. The House of Mouse had a prolific, inventive run of movies back then, which of course featured in The Lighthouse, Helen Reddy singing Lighthouse on the Water. Welcome back, Tara Bennett. Hopefully that moment just transported us for a few moments to a classy. Now,
it did.
Will one go to see the remake of Pete's Dragon with that sense of will it be desecrated? Will it be sacrilege? We've got Bryce Dallas Howard in there. So, you know, she was good in Spider-Man. Ron Howard connection from that point of view. Jurassic World, of course. Although I think, you know, Jurassic World and Pete's Dragon, not to be confused. You know, you could easily sort of think.
Oh, I can see, get them confused, yeah.
Are they still doing it as a musical, or are they just doing a version of it?
Tara, you had this wonderful lead article, so share with us the whole sort of notion in which the quote, "I hope people who love the original love it, but if they don't, I understand."
Yeah, it's completely different. If you're going to do a reboot, I think it's probably one of the smartest ways of going about doing it. That David Lowery, who's the director of it, did not in any way want to step on the train of what you just played. I, as a kid, I had that soundtrack and listened to it until it didn't work anymore. And it's a strange, you know, this hybrid movie back in the day with the live action, with the animated dragon, and what David wanted to do was wipe out all of the musicality out of it and just actually set it in that kind of era when that movie first came out, around kind of 70s. So there isn't really an idea of this pervasion of technology that we have with kids nowadays, where their faces are in the little in their phones, and that there is this sense of magic and the sense that kids back in those days were far more open to the stories of what could be out there, what could be out in the woods, the magic that's out there. And it's I've seen half of it, and when I went to do these interviews, and it really is extremely charming. There's a kind of throwback element to it that is really, really lovely, and I think, you know, it's kind of like the best kind of contemporary reworking of a story that's beloved. It's certainly not stepping on the path. It's not trying to shot for shot remake anything, which is what so many people go, why are you even bothering to do it?
Yes, they do that.
Exactly, and yet it's also going back to the things that I think people loved in spirit about Pete's Dragon, and just adapting that for this new generation. And so it's getting great reviews, and that's really lovely. And it is being called a throwback, which I think is really lovely too. It's not a cynical take; it's a very sweet take, and it's something that I think a lot of people have been wanting in terms of, if you're going to revisit a property, let's try to do it in this kind of fashion.
I love the quote, and as you know, Tara, I always like to select some of the quotes that you produce for us on these programs. The producers agreed about Pete's Dragon. The mandate from the studio was, we want to make a movie called Pete's Dragon. It has to have a boy named Pete in it, and a dragon. That's it. That's the sort of simplicity you want. Oh, you know, none of this...
No, that's where an editor's been at work.
Yeah, exactly. That's insightful, that is. That's brilliant.
The thing that immediately strikes me, though, about hearing about beloved Pete Dragon, and yes, it is even to me, I immediately want to go and buy a copy and make sure that my 23-year-old daughter sees the original first.
Yeah.
I am so weird that way, because, I mean, I think Hollywood completely ruined Fright Night for me by putting Colin Farrell first, whatever his name is, in it, and it was the most dreadful version I've ever seen. I'm sorry, I love David Tennant, but he was awful.
And the new version of The Fog was dreadful.
Absolutely awful.
The new version of The Fog.
Oh, The Fog, oh, yeah. Well. I don't, you know, so terrible my natural instinct is to hate this immediately before I even see it.
Having
heard what you said, I will give it a chance, but I'm going to make sure my daughter's seen the original. If she hasn't already, and I suspect she has.
Presumably it's Disney again, Tara.
Of course it's Disney.
It is.
Yeah.
It's Disney, and I think that's the greatest thing, is when they do something with the right spirit, and David Lowery was really, really... adamant about making sure that this was a story that was about characters rather than it just being about the CGI dragon, which I think is helpful to hear in the beginning, because obviously most of the time it's going to be all about the dragon, and then people are going to be running around chasing it, whatever. And David is known as this kind of independent, small movie, quirky kind of character stories. And Disney, weirdly, I'll say that, allowed him to do that, because they... I think what they wanted to do was they wanted to try to contemporize it, but not set a mandate for it. And they literally said, if we don't like the script, then we just won't make it. It was just an exploration of what could you do with a Pete Dragon story, and David came up with something that they were really, really pleased with. He's actually working on a Peter Pan remake right now, which I don't know if we need that, but if he obviously had a successful take on this, and I think you're 100% right, I agree. This is a great opportunity to say to your kids, here's what I loved when I watched this, and I adored the original Pete Dragon, and then hopefully give them an experience that they'll get to compare and contrast and maybe love both of them if they're both genuinely great movies, which is always a nice and rare thing. And I totally agree with your Fright Night assessment, too. There's been way too many of these movies that have either been slavish to repeating what was magic about it in the first place and then failing utterly to, to recreate that.
And you know what was the horrific thing about that? It was the same writer that did the the script of the new one as and it was dreadful.
Proves the magic of casting and directing and, you know, tone. It is sometimes,
and of course, no Chris Sarandon,
that we love so much. They're lightning in a bottle. You know, don't mess with something that's really wonderful. But if you are going to do it, try to make it your own. Don't try to make it what it was that made it special. So hopefully this will be a more successful, maybe even a template to show, hey, if you're going to do it, try along these lines instead.
In the words of indie director-writer David Lowery, it's beloved by many people, but it's not so beloved that you can't take it and run. And besides, as well as Bryce Dallas Howard, you've got Robert Redford and Carl Urban in the movie. So it's looking good in terms of, you know, taking that emotional journey. Okay. All sorts of things there. So,
Robert Redford's amazing in it. He's so wonderful in it. He's such a great actor. And then when you see him really doing what he does best, it's really a thrill. So I'll say that he is a definite plus for this movie as well. Mm.
You've sold me on it.
There we are.
I got to see it.
Okay.
Yell at me
on Twitter if I'm wrong.
I will.
Did I hear somewhere, Tara, that they're remaking Dario Argento's Suspiria?
They've talked about it. That one, I think, is a far more difficult one.
Oh,
for
my goodness me.
To do. I know.
Why?
Everything is we were talking from my rants and raves. They're talking about redoing Big Trouble in Little China with The Rock, and that murders my soul.
Oh, no.
Terrible.
Absolutely.
No.
Just breathe, Tara. That's even breathe at these moments.
I know.
Tara, talking about Dario Argento's Suspiria, though. That's a piece of art. It's like taking a Picasso and saying you can paint it better than he did. You know, I'm going to do it again.
There's a hubris.
There's a
hubris, exactly, that's inherent with trying to say, do you honestly think you make a better version than what Argento did? It's kind of ridiculous.
Unbelievably beautifully shot. Yes. And I just don't think anyone could do it any better. No. All right, there might be able to tighten the story up.
Be inspired and make your own story, but leave his work to be what it is, which is, you know, cinema changing. So, I 100% agree.
We're actually talking about another Disney film on the Stone Tapes.
Something Wicked This Way Comes.
This Way Comes.
Oh, that was
love
Disney.
And that's one I don't think that has ever been remade or retried, has it?
No, there's actually some, it's so funny that you mention that. I was so honored to be able, because I live in California and there are these really great little shops sometimes that cater to these kind of strange titles that maybe aren't super mainstream but really had an impact on our generation. There was actually a Q&A for the original soundtrack for Something Wicked This Way Comes, which was replaced by James Horner,
who, of
course, is, you know, a fabulous composer, but Disney was very frightened by what they originally had come up with. And so we got to actually talk with one of the editors from the film and the wife of soundtrack, the man who actually did the original score, and a couple other people from inside that had researched this movie heavily during the time it was being created and the problems that happened behind the scenes. And that is a film that still has a lot of rights issues. And because of that, it has been really complicated for it to actually be remade. They have talked about it, And Disney definitely has it as a property. You know, it, that was during
Disney. Could that be the reason, Tara, they're not going to do... Is that possibly one of the reasons they're going to do Song of the South in the near future? That's the thought there, yes.
Yeah. Song of the South keeps trying to get very different involved as quickly as they possibly can. Exactly.
I'm still looking for Birth of a Nation. Perhaps not. I'm just going to show
that's
you...
That's a double feature right there.
Yeah, exactly. When otters get bored, they juggle rocks. I mean, this is the thing that sort of always impresses me. I mean, Tara can bring...
I like to think my Facebook is a place for good Oz every day. Exactly. People send me awesome otter pictures, and you can find Alice on a bad day on my Facebook wall. Please come and join me.
And that's all we actually need to actually talk about otters juggling rocks.
Fantastic.
A reminder, you can read the full awesome Tara Bennett article with the director of the new version of Pete's Dragon in the current edition of SFX magazine, the world's number one science fiction magazine. We haven't had a chance, Tara, to talk about some of the other goodies that you're involved with. I won't talk about Ice Age 5 because that doesn't seem to have quite worked, really.
Here's where I've been at. Yeah, I did the art of Ice Age, which is all five films and the short films. I and the artists are super proud of being able to show the beauty of what they've done over the years, 14 years, with the art of that. Yeah. As for the latest film, we'll just let that rest.
Well, that's why we had a beep. We actually came in there because we could obviously tell that there was some sort of expletive that was coming through with respect to that, but never mind. Perhaps 5 was just a bit too far to go. Even Star Trek 5, the final frontier directed by William Shatner, had its challenges when they tried to actually find God. But then, what does God need with a starship? We've just actually had an incoming message from Anna Lewis, who said, try the mobile phone. I don't know what a mobile phone
mobile
is.
Mobile phone is. Oh,
we might try and squeeze in a few moments before we actually head off to Phil Leonis. Patricia, you're new to this whole sequence, but you've done the show several times before.
Yes.
If I said ask Tara those last two questions, would you kind of feel you wanted to give it a stab? I mean, Jason's already said, no, don't try me. But wait, go.
Have you had an interesting telephonic link with us?
I have, thank you.
Don't sound so surprised, Tara. We like to feel there's a modicum of quality here.
Alex, that's the second question.
Is she going to return?
Oh, would you like to return?
Yes, very much so, thank you.
And talking about remakes... Now, clearly, if you wanted to actually unpick the themes of the programme from Chasing Dragons, from San Francisco, from a variety of other things, you could do so. But we wouldn't encourage you to do that. Just make of it what you will. The team remains a quartet of quality with Sam Stone, David J. Howe, Professor Jason Whittaker, and Patricia Ash. And online, hopefully now, if he's got his first cup of coffee, which is not good for the migraine and so on, but he's having a bit of a poorly time, we have Ace Director, the man who actually said things that Tara Bennett agreed with this time around. It's not been a great summer for blockbusters. It's Phil Leonis. How are you, Phil?
Hey, Phil.
It's Lily Holliman.
Hey!
Oh, it's even better. It's fantastic. Lily Holliman, who's probably never heard of Trumpton in her entire existence. Oh. But, you know, she will one of these days. Because Lily has a starring role in The Lady Killers, and she's very good. One of the great things about that, that's all. It's a bit dangerous, particularly when she strangles somebody. But, you know.
Oh, you're going to have to look at that. I haven't seen that one.
Spoiler alert.
Don't spoil it. Do ladies get killed?
No, I think it's about ladies who kill, is it?
Look, don't try and explain the meaning. Otherwise, we'll get into the deep meaning and Wittgensteinian meaning and understanding of Suicide Squad. It's there. It's just Nietzschean in its experience.
And Kafkaian.
And Kafkaian. Exactly. A trial.
Yes.
In many ways.
It's a very literary show.
Or a metamorphosis sort of emerges. That's, and suddenly you wake up and you think, public relations scored what? Oh, never mind. I'm very confused about the whole thing. Anyway, Lily, how are you? She's gone very quiet.
I'm great.
Good.
How are you?
Good. That's all right. Is it you who is poorly, or is it Phil who's poorly? Because I'm very confused now. Phil picked up the phone, and he's gone off to make coffee. Is that the case?
Yeah, he's about done with his cup of coffee, and I'm filling in until he's back with his cup of coffee.
That's all right. And what kind of coffee does he take? I mean, is it authentic coffee? Is it instant? Is it high caffeine content? What's the official Leonis take on the coffee cup in the morning?
He's very interested in the dark roast with low acid from Trader Joe's that he grounds from the beans.
Oh, lovely.
And he does... He does this very fancy air press method.
Ah.
That he's just completed.
So it's not a case of just
put
some sachets in and hope for the best. It's wonderful. I mean, it strikes me as rather similar to the coffee
machine.
Lily, it's been a fantastic summer. I feel as though I've been not quite fully connected with Lily there. It's curious. We had a better instantaneous connection with Buck on a tram in San Francisco than we had, you know, Lily somewhere in Los Angeles.
But there's a bit of a pause between us.
It all works well. I was just thinking it reminded me very much of the coffee machine that Roger Moore's 007 uses in Live and Let Die, which is very complex as well in terms of using the line, of course, by Bernard Lee's M is that all it does?
Makes coffee. Yes.
Exactly. Phil, have you got your coffee in hand now, and are you ready to go?
It was a disaster. I didn't have my glasses on, and it was just I'm gonna have to redo this cup. But I will wait. I'll wait during the middle of a David Soul song or something like that. A David Cassidy song, whatever David you choose to play.
We've already had David Bowie with the theme to Professor Jason Whittaker and Ziggy Stardust. So we've had our David for the day. We can't have two.
You know, David for the day.
David Squared.
You know, I watched late into the night last night, which turned out not to be such a good call because waking up early and feeling awful this morning. But I watched a brilliant movie last night, and I think I will always now, when I think of David Bowie, I will also think of Alan Rickman because of how closely aligned their deaths were at the beginning of this year. Mm. But I saw Alan Rickman's final screen performance in Eye in the Sky, starring Helen Mirren. And what an amazing, amazing, wonderful, unsettling, thought-provoking film this was. So it was nice to see at least this work that Alan Rickman left us with. But amazing to think that Alan Rickman never even got nominated for an Academy Award in his career.
That is shocking, considering
how unfair.
What an amazing actor he was.
Yeah.
You probably haven't caught any of the programmers yet, Phil, but thankfully there are always the podcasts to catch up on things such as our summer of sad blockbuster sequels, really, which haven't quite worked. But I must admit, I'm saying this, Jason, because the negativity that oozed forward from this week's Chill Pack Hollywood scenario over Suicide Squad and DC Universe—it was. I just thought, just Phil, just ease back. You know, somebody enjoyed them. He did actually say somebody possibly did somewhere, but not many people.
No, we did talk about how some people have enjoyed it, but the mental illness those people are expressing publicly is more no. That isn't even a joke. I'll tell a joke later. There's just been such a rabid, almost mentally ill expressions of support for this film from people, as opposed to, like, as Dean expresses it, it's fine. Just like it. Just love it. You know, you're allowed to like whatever you want, but it's very odd. We're living in a very strange and unsettling time for film. But I kind of feel like it's a reflection of how everyone's attitudes towards corporations and these giant corporate conglomerates are in general. Why would film now be any different? It's so contentious, it's so divisive, and no one's going to see these films. That's the bottom line, is that just a huge amount of money is being spent and lost. You know, even with the quote-unquote big hits, so here Suicide Squad opens to the fourth biggest summer opening ever, and it's going to lose a couple of $100 million. So it's everything needs to be rethought right now. Especially because there's so much that people can do. They don't need to go to the movies anymore. There's so much more that they will enjoy.
Jason, you chose to go and see Star Trek Beyond.
I did.
You were disappointed, as you said. You felt that it didn't sort of quite work. What were the issues about Star Trek Beyond which you kind of came away thinking?
It was that a lot of these blockbuster movies have become big, baggy monsters, and it's almost as though you pay 15 quid or wherever to go to the cinema, so you've got to have your 2.5 hours experience. And to hell with simple character development, plot, a decent script. It's get the next effect in.
Could this be that, as Phil Linus introduced the notion that this year the humanities have actually gone from ephemeral to disposable in just 100 years?
Interesting.
I don't have a quick witty one-liner. I suddenly realised I was going into lecture mode. That the humanities have never been. In one sense, I think the 20th century saw the humanities become part of a wider remit for lots of people as part of higher education. Prior to that, they were very much an elite. They were only peripheral activity for a vast majority of people. And the terrible thing is that might be starting to happen again. That's the depressing thought.
Phil, have you got any response to that? I appreciate you weren't ready to actually engage in debate on it.
As indeed was I.
Yeah, throwing our thesis at him that we discussed over a period of an hour is a little unfair, but without him being prepared for it. But we were just talking about the fact that the nature of the performing arts were always ephemeral because there was no recorded music, no film, no plays were not recorded. In fact, this is, if you read about, like in London, major art shows, like the Academy art shows, hundreds of thousands of people would attend this because literally paintings were it, right? This was not ephemeral in the sense that it existed in a fixed form and always would, but still your experience with that painting was ephemeral because you could not take it with you. And here we are 100 years later, and everything in some concretized form is available for you at the push of a button. You can, avail yourself of almost every movie ever made in one form or another online. You can avail yourself of every bit of music ever recorded, every book ever written. These things are all easily accessible. And because you can get anything you want at any time, if something does not please you almost immediately, you can let it go and seek out something that will, quote-unquote, please you. And so there's a degree to which all of it is now easily disposable. You don't have to connect with it, work with it, open yourself to it. And it's led to some really disturbing trends in terms of how people consume and interact with the arts, with the humanities. And even when they do go to live events, which are meant to be ephemeral, which are meant to live on only in the memory, more and more of the time I see people simply spending all their time, if they're paying attention at all, recording it, taking photos, not actually...
Or indeed, as I mentioned, somebody who actually within seconds of Suicide Squad starting actually using their mobile phones to just text. Seconds of the actual opening sequence. Sorry.
Maybe they were live tweeting it.
And you know... people are on their mobiles a lot in theaters. And, you know, Dean asked a really good question. I'm so glad you brought this up. Dean asked a really good question on this show, my co-host Dean Haglund from The X-Files. He said, well, what happened to the ability to dampen signals so that people can't use their mobile phones? Wouldn't that just ease the problem? Instead of making announcements that everyone ignores, keep your mobile phone off, why don't they just dampen the signal like they do at major events where they think it could be a potential security hazard to let people get a signal? And I said, I don't know, because honestly, that's out of my bailiwick. And I then checked my email. We recorded the show about 12 hours before we made it available. And in the minutes after I recorded that show, I realized I had received an email from a listener who had not heard our show yet. And he sent me an article to a newspaper somewhere there in the UK with a picture of Dean Haglund, my co-host, in his character from The X-Files, as a computer hacker, talking about how UK establishments, in this case a couple of bars, have built absolutely cheap Faraday cages within their confines for exactly that reason, to prevent cell phone usage. Mm.
Jason, what do you think that would be a good sign? Because clearly there are academics who would turn around and say, yes, from the moment the lecture starts, get your mobile phones out and tweet away.
I tweet your lectures.
Exactly.
Although I'm not willing.
It happens. But where do we see it? Because it is something where, as Phil's just alluded to there, it kind of takes away from that experience of the event if you're looking constantly for selfies. Or I did like the little line that was featured in Private Eye recently, where we have a chap who holds up his selfie stick and says, but I've got 4,320 friends on Facebook, still can't find somebody to take a photograph of me.
I do appreciate the ephemeral experience, and very much for being there and enjoying it without any... In fact, it's so rare that we actually have those moments where we're not mediating it in some shape or form. So, yeah. To watch a... live
theatre. Midweek Drive is recorded before a live audience. I say this consistently.
But, yeah, going to theatre in particular is just one of the best experiences.
Agreed.
I think also we're using different parts of the brain. We're accessing the information through different parts of our entire body when we're at a live experience. The energy that is there, we are either letting in through different parts of ourselves, or we're blocking it out with different parts of ourselves. But I get back more and more often to this study that I read about the importance of reading. Certainly before you go to bed, reading not from a backlit screen, but reading from actual print material. And in fact, if you're reading fiction, it's really much more advisable to read from a printed material than from a backlit screen anyway, because when you read from a backlit screen, you are actually using a different part of your brain, and it is not the part of the brain that allows you to be forming empathetic connections, the part that allows us to, what would it be, identify with characters to really explore their plights. We use a different part of our brain for that, and it's the part that's activated when we have a tactile material in front of us. Fascinating stuff, but then it also then make, I think of that when I am at a concert and people are constantly going back and forth from the concert to this backlit screen, almost as if the parts of themselves they need to access in a live event, now they're so out of use of accessing that it makes them uncomfortable to do so, and they need to go back to the comfort, to the security of what they get from these mobile devices.
Interesting lines. But in deference to Professor Whitaker's criticism earlier in the programme, Phil, I take it you haven't heard the early part of the production at all, or have you?
I mean, in the sense...
Yes or no will do. Yes or no will do.
Doing the show every week for... No, I haven't.
No, you haven't. Good. That's okay.
I'm barely hanging on here.
Phil, it's okay. We're going to be heading off in a few moments. But, Phil, the two whales in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, were their names?
Well, so apparently I did hear the show, because I was going to say I can absolutely guarantee that there were references to Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, earlier in the show. It was George and Gracie, a pair of humpbacks that live in the Cetacean Institute in Sausalito, a non-existent place in ordinary reality. There you go.
So that was the reason why I'm sure Buck is looking for the Sausalito Institute of Oceanic Research in San Francisco even as we speak, which is the important thing. And if you want to have an R factor, there we
go. It does not exist.
Yet.
It was the Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Yes.
They used the location of the Monterey Bay Aquarium and called it Sausalito. But the Monterey Bay Aquarium never has and never will have whales in captivity.
No, precisely. We moved on from that point.
Difficult. Whales are very difficult to keep in captivity.
As SeaWorld have found.
Yeah,
but let's not go there, because before you know where you have it, you'll have people denying that the colour change in Rio is due to people getting overexcited in the pool. No, it's got nothing to do with that at all, really. It's just changed colour from blue to green. Happy birthday to Fuzz Aldrin, 5 years young.
Aww.
Exactly. Aww. It's not just Tara Bennett who can do an R photograph on Facebook. Phil Leonis can wrap it up as well. Superb stuff there. So well done. Have you been watching the Olympics, Phil? I gather you have, really, and have been quite surprised by the level of competition and the tension that's been bounced up there. But you did particularly like the British undercurrent of calmness that that ensues when you actually have a pile-up in the cycling race. I think you need to deliver this as we begin to wrap up the program.
All right. Yes, I have been trying to avail myself as much Olympic coverage as possible. It's been many, many years since I've watched an Olympics. And so I don't know these athletes, so I have no rooting interest. It's just wonderful to get to become acquainted with the stories and the characters. But I love particularly when there are British announcers on some of these events, especially in the case of cycling. Cycling seems to be one of the only things that ever will appear when I turn on a television. And this race in Rio was, it was hairy. Half the people did not finish the race. The conditions were so difficult. But right after a particularly nasty wipeout, I mean, injuries, bodies piled upon bodies, just terrible, terrible images on my screen. And the British announcer managing to keep it calm by saying at first, "Oh, did you look at that? Did you see that?" And then he calmed and he said, "Those corners can be quite dodgy," which I thought was a wonderful understatement.
Well, it's almost
keeping calm and carrying on. There we go.
It's the motto of the program. Patricia, would you like to give me a number between 2 and 27, please?
25.
25. Interesting.
I have a special request to pass on to you directly from the morning sun herself, echoed by the clear blue sky, the earth under your feet, and the trees in your life who each long for your passing. From time to time, however sporadic or brief, they'd absolutely adore your undivided attention. I know I'd want to know, so I thought you would too. The universe. P.S. I know, you can't be everything to every tree, but you come amazingly close.
exactly. It's the tree factor.
Can I tell you why that one is so creepy? That one is particularly creepy, and Mike Dooley should understand this for Americans, because he says that all the trees and the clouds and everything long for our passing. In America, where we have a very unhealthy relationship with lots of things, but especially death, we can't even say that someone died. All we ever say is they passed. And that's our thing. Whenever anyone says passing, they automatically think you're talking about someone died. So when I hear the clouds and the mountains and the trees are longing for my passing, I go, well, why do they want me to die? That's a mean, mean thing for them to want.
Because deforestation.
Exactly. And in the words of George Mann, who sadly has not been able to join us for the Midweek Drive, it would be an arboreal apocalypse.
Yes.
Oh, so that relates to Doctor Who edition that he's produced. There we are, George. I'm giving him shameless plugs for his routine, an arboreal apocalypse. We have to head off into the wild beyond because the team who actually are covering the American presidential elections are on board now. They've got CIA snipers across different parts of the studio. Lord knows what's going to be happening. They've got the Earth, Wind and Fire logo. It's all set and ready to actually go with this. Oh, wow. It's astounding. But Patricia, have you enjoyed your part of the programme so far?
I have.
And Sam Stone?
Always.
And David J. Howe?
Oh, yes.
And Professor Jason Whittaker?
As ever, Alex.
We thank Cameron Tilbury, Anna Lewis, William Co. Oh, we don't think Anna Lewis, because she just communicated via saying her mobile phone number is so-and-so. Anyway, thanks to Cameron Tilbury, William Cole, Stephen Lane, P.F. Buck, in San Francisco, Tara Bennett, in Los Angeles. We didn't get a chance to even speak about the San Diego Comic Con, well, with Pete's Dragon. What's not to appreciate from that point of view? And Phil Leonis. Phil, have you enjoyed the programme from your own perspective today?
I've enjoyed it as much as I am capable of. However, tell your correspondents, I think we're going to cancel the presidential election at least until we're all better rested in this country.
Good idea.
Nice thought. You remember where you heard it first. We support you, dear listener, as well from that point of view. We're going out with Riot in Cell Block Number 9, live with Dr. Feelgood. Can we all say bye-bye?
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.